Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to Golf Talk Live. I'm your host, Ted Odorico. I want to thank all of you for joining me this evening. We've got a great show for you. I've got a gentleman that has been planning on coming on the show here for a little while, and we finally lassoed him and got him to come on here, and he's going to be joining me here in just a few minutes. But I want to thank all of you for tuning in from all around the globe and listening to Golf Talk Live tonight, and thank you for doing so. Just to remind everybody, before Paul comes on, we are live every Thursday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. Central Time, and that's 7 to 9 for those of you on the East Coast here in the United States. And for those of you on the West Coast, out in California per se, it would be 4 to 6 we'll be live during the Thursday night broadcast. For some reason, if you're not able to join us during the live broadcast, not a problem. All of the shows, of course, are auto-recorded. So you can visit the link, which I'll give you here in just a second, and you can listen to the recorded version if you're not able to join us live. And that link, of course, is blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive, or the easiest way is to go to blogtalkradio.com and up in the search key type Golf Talk Live, and that will get you there as well. And basically, it will take you to a main page. And, of course, during the Thursday live broadcast, the broadcast show will be at the top of the page. But if you happen, as I said, if you happen to miss the broadcast and you want to tune in, you can just scroll down into the on-demand section, and it will be the most current show will always be at the top. And then, of course, you can scroll down and visit or revisit any of the shows that you might have missed that have been earlier previously broadcast. Excuse me. If you want to speak to any of the guests during the live broadcast on Thursday night, you're welcome to do so by simply calling in at area code 646-716-4667. The number again is area code 646-716-4667. Or you're welcome to email me personally any questions or comments about the show to ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. And also, if you're in the golf industry, whether you're a teaching professional or a player or maybe somebody, maybe you're an entrepreneur and you've got something that you want to share with the audience that's golf, of course, golf related. Maybe you've got a product or a theory that you want to discuss. Always looking for new and interesting guests to come on the show. You can also reach out and email me at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. Just send me your contact information and I'll reach out as quick as I can. And just to let you know, we're booking. Obviously, July is currently booked, but working on, I still got a few spots left in August, and of course working on September as well. So appreciate all of the comments and that I've been receiving over the last little while. I always look forward to that. And keep those questions coming as well, coming into the program. And that email is a little bit different. If you have questions that you want to pose to the Coach's Corner panels that come on the show, you can send them to questions.golftalklive@gmail.com. That's questions.golftalklive@gmail.com. So keep them coming. Just to let you know, obviously I haven't mentioned the Coach's Corner panel tonight, giving the guys and gals a little bit of a break this week and next week. I'm actually going to be off on holiday for a week, starting next week. So I'm actually not going to do the Golf Talk Live broadcast and or the Women of Golf show that Cindy and I do on Tuesday morning. So those are going to be canceled for next week, but we'll be returning on air the following week, which I believe starts the 20th. I think the 21st is the Tuesday and the 23rd is the Thursday. So we'll be back on a regular schedule from that point on. But take a little break and decide to give the Coach's Corner panel this week and next week a little bit of a break. Obviously, people are taking holidays and are busy, very busy this time of year. So I like to certainly respect that and block some time off so they can go and enjoy family or maybe they've got some things going on at work with their teaching or instructions that they need to do. So no Coach's Corner tonight, but I got a great guest coming up here in just a few moments. Also, I like to update the program through social media. Of course, most of you that follow the show and with any sort of regularity know that I post everything on Facebook and Twitter. If you want to know where things are at Facebook, go to facebook.com/Golf Talk Live blog. And while you're there, appreciate it if you throw a few likes my way. Always appreciate that. And thank you for those that have done so recently. And also on Twitter, if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's Ted and Buck CEO is my handle. It's Ted and Buck CEO and CEO, of course, in capitals. And you can also send your comments or questions through Twitter as well. Always look forward to getting those. And also, if you have time, visit the Golf Talk Live website, and that is at www.golftalkliveblog.com. And excuse me, as I mentioned here just a few moments ago, my special guest tonight, of course, is going to be Mr. Paul Kaster. He is the Director of Instruction at Forest Gate Country Club up in New Jersey. Let me just tell you a little bit about him before I bring you on, and then Paul and I are going to have a little discussion, talk a little bit about what he's doing to help grow this game and just some other questions along the way, maybe talk a little bit about what's happening on the tour as well. But let me just tell you a little bit about Paul's background, and then we'll bring him on. Paul, as I mentioned, is the Director of Instruction at Forest Gate Country Club in Monroe, New Jersey. He learned the game in Chicago's only 18-hole public golf course, Jackson Park, and went on to play Division I college golf and on some of the mini tours, including the Tar Heel Tour, which is now the eGolf Tour, as well as the Golden Bear Tour, which is now, of course, referred to the Gateway Tour. After suffering a wrist injury, he left the golf business to pursue a career in law. So he is a lawyer as well. We'll ask him a little bit about that. But realized after passing two of the bars and practicing for several years that he wanted to return to golf to share his passion for the game. We're grateful that he has for learning with his students. And he is the Northern New Jersey Director of Instruction for Medicus Golf, Five Simple Keys system. He's also a member of Callaway Golf's professional staff proponent group and is a certified instructor with the Seymour Putter Company and also U.S. Kids Golf. In his off season, he coaches indoors at Golf Cave in Clark, New Jersey, and Test Sports Clubs in Martinsville, New Jersey. And if you want to find out more about Paul, you can also, after the show, of course, you can visit his website at www.paulcastergolf.com. So without any further hesitation, let me bring on tonight's guest, Mr. Paul Kaster. Good evening, Paul. Welcome to Golf Talk Live.
Hi, Ted. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. I appreciate you taking some time this evening. I know it's always busy after a hard day to want to relax and unwind, but I appreciate you taking time and coming on the program tonight. I thought, obviously, the most obvious question really to start things off, Paul, is just to tell a little bit more about your background. As I mentioned in the intro, you're also an attorney and have practiced for a number of years. So tell us a little bit about that. You were in golf for a while, then obviously developed a wrist injury and decided to pursue some other avenues. Tell us a little bit about that journey and then obviously what brought you back into golf.
Yeah, sure. I'm very serious about golf. When I went to college, I fully intended to play on the PGA Tour and, you know, just like a lot of other kids, and played mm-hmm. pretty well. And actually played at Colgate University, was the captain of the team there, and decided to leave early because I was so I was playing well and really kind of not digging the snow in upstate New York for 6 months out of the year. So I ended up going down and playing mini tours for 3 years and had some people who thankfully were able to support me doing that. And some people back from Chicago who had kind of always said that they would. And so I was able to do that and played okay. and then, you know, eventually injured my wrist, like you said. And that was just kind of an accidental thing. You know, I hit a shot from an area under a tree that I didn't really think that there was any, you know, real issue with, and it just happened that the ball was sitting next to a root. And so that these things happen. So I ended up having to make a choice back then. You know, I couldn't play. Doctors were kind of saying, well, you know, it could be a year. We don't really, you know, you're going to have surgery or not, but one way or the other, it could be a very long time. And it was sort of a 50-50 proposition as to whether or not my wrist was going to be any good. I decided to go back to school and finished undergrad, went to law school at the University of Miami. My mother's an attorney. My grandfather was an attorney. And, you know, when I went back to school, I kind of got involved, became a little bit political or was interested in politics. And so being involved in that process, law school was kind of, you know, a natural next step. And then I did that, graduated from law school, passed the New York and New Jersey bars, like you mentioned, and
right.
Actually went to work for the New Jersey Attorney General's office.
Wow.
And actually I had a clerkship for a judge before that and then went to the AG's office. And, you know, I have to say that the whole time I never really enjoyed it nearly as much as I enjoyed being around the game. And I had taught quite a bit, you know, when I was playing, I kind of taught at one of the clubs where I was practicing and playing as well. And so I did that for, you know, 5 years or so. Went to work for a firm after 3 years at the Attorney General's office prosecuting criminal cases. And then, you know, thankfully, kind of my wife supported the idea of making a switch, and I had an opportunity to do that. And I went to work at a club here in New Jersey. And that was initially just in golf operations.
Now, let me ask you, because it raises kind of an interesting question, being an attorney, and obviously you were in a sort of a different field, if you will, as an attorney, but certainly gave you access to some knowledge. As a golf professional, one of the things that you have to be, especially if you're going to have your own business, now you could certainly work for clubs and things like that, but you also primarily have your own business. You're essentially self-employed in many cases. Being an attorney, does it give you a little bit of an advantage to understand how business works and how to set things up properly? I think a lot of people, when they start businesses or they get out in the workforce, especially if they're going to be self-employed, don't always understand some of the legalities of what they need to do and to set themselves up properly. Obviously, you want to consult with a tax advisor as well. Did you find that gave you some insight when you decided to get back into golf a little bit, or did you pretty much have most of that knowledge ahead of time?
You know, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think having all of the education and the experience with that stuff and, you know, to pass the bar and to get through law school, you have to take a pretty wide-ranging set of courses, obviously, or subject matter. So I, at the AG's office, never dealt with business law per se. I did a little bit at the firm that I worked at. But definitely, you know, it changes your frame of mind, I would say, you know, for sure. And so, yeah, I think understanding the ins and outs of LLCs and insurance and making sure that all that type of thing, all those types of things are covered is definitely pretty helpful.
Well, I think it gives you an advantage. I think, well, obviously most of the guys and gals that get into the golf business usually have a pretty good understanding of business, but I think that any additional education that you can get and bring to the table gives you a little bit of an advantage when venturing out on your own. I think too many people come up with a great idea, and I'm not even talking about golf, but just in general, and a lot of times don't really have it's one thing to have the skill set to be able to perform the task at hand, but there's a lot of other things that go behind the scenes that most people don't really prepare properly for. So I can see where that additional education, your sense, again, even though you didn't study specifically for business law, would certainly give you some general insight in how to prepare yourself to be a golf professional.
Definitely, yeah. You know, I think it's one of I've been back in the golf business for probably four or five years now, something like that, and it's one of the reasons I think that I've been pretty successful. You know, after having come back to the business, just I've a pretty organized way of going about things for sure.
Yeah, and that goes without saying. I think obviously as an attorney you have to be, but that certainly again that sort of transfers over into being a golf professional as well. You can take some of those skill sets that you've learned through being an attorney. Also, I see that you're very involved in junior golf, which obviously is important to anybody that's in this business now and ways of growing the game. You have some great coaching programs and indicate that yours actually – now, there's a lot of – let me just preface this a little bit. There is a lot of junior golf programs out there. I think any – program out there that inspires or encourages youngsters to get involved in the game, I think, is good. But obviously, some are better than others. What are some of the programs that you, either you're directly or indirectly involved with, or that you work with yourself, and how are they successful? Maybe compared to some of the others that you're familiar with.
Well, so I'm new at Forsgate this year, and so we're in the process of running the programs that exist there already and in the process of developing new ones. And I came from a facility that has, I would say, probably the most successful junior golf program, possibly, definitely, I would say, in the north, in the tri-state area, I think, and in New Jersey for sure. I was at Roycebrook Golf Club last year, and we had 300 and I think it was like 15 kids in the junior program there.
Wow.
And yeah, it was just tremendous. And a lot of the kids were very competitive. Four of my students right now are going to be going to the U.S. Kids World Golf Championships next week at Pinehurst, or 2 weeks from now, I guess. And so the programs there, because of the size and scale of the facility and the junior golf program, were different because it's just it was a much bigger thing. PGA Junior League is, I would say, easily the most successful junior golf program that I've had a chance to be around and that I've run so far. We're running one right now at Forsgate. And I'm also running kind of a Friday afternoon junior program for kids who are involved in that, but also kids who are a little bit too old. And that runs Friday afternoons all the way through the year. We're going to be growing something coming fall. We're going to be doing a Saturday afternoon program also. So the PGA Junior League is just incredible. I mean, have you had any direct experience with it?
Not personally, no. I am familiar with it, so I know that I'm familiar with their curriculum and that, but I haven't personally, no. What are some of the things that you have yourself in some of the coaching programs that you're doing? What are some of the things that you like about the programs that you're doing and how they're becoming effective with what you're doing? And what are some things that you would like to improve or add on while you're at Forsgate?
I really enjoy doing these programs because they help people who are committed get better and understand how to become, you know, good scoring golfers. And I guess by that I mean that, you know, we're building a full basket of skills. A lot of golfers, I think, equate golf swing to improving at golf.
Right.
And, but, you know, so when they come, one of the hardest things about golf instruction, I think, for a teacher is that a student controls the subject matter of the lesson in a lot of ways. So if you have somebody who's struggling and more, you know, more often than not, they come for help with their golf swing, that might not help lower their scores the fastest, and they may not end up practicing as much or in the way that you'd like them to, ideally. And so they don't end up getting as much improvement, and you know, you end up kind of feeling like you're not helping them as much as you could. So by creating kind of a structured program that you do assessments as part of the program, you have a stats program, you're able to monitor somebody's progress. You know, I use LightScope and some other things to kind of really measure people's abilities, measure people's progress. You can prove to somebody that that you know they're getting better, that these are the things that are going to help them, and then you can focus on short game and putting as well. So that's I've had really great results. I have a student who's been with me since I would say I think May of last year, who's gone from shooting in the 130s to shooting in the low 80s. And,
wow.
You know, a couple of other people like that who, if they're willing to make the commitment, they're actually going to get a really good deal on the instruction, and they're going to get a lot of improvement, I think, too.
And I think, you know, you raise an interesting point. You know, more often than not, when students come to you, regardless of age, really we have to, as teacher professionals, we have to do you know, certainly a thorough assessment to find out what their needs are, what they're looking for, and that. But there are some that obviously come that are pretty well informed. They know what they want. They have specific things they're looking to accomplish, so they can be sometimes a little bit easier to guide and coach. But then there's others that come that, as you said, that struggle and maybe a little more confused. So is there a time, do you think, that Paul, that obviously through the assessment, that you have to sort of make a mental decision yourself and say, okay, this is somebody I think that's kind of on the right path, maybe a little adjustments here and there, maybe to keep them on that path. And then there's others that come in that are sort of all over the map that you have to sort of take and handhold, if you will. Do you find that that's something that you have to sort of shift gears through your instruction?
Sometimes, yeah. I think, you know, perception is an interesting thing. I think even good players sometimes can be wrong about what they're necessarily good at, and that's what shot by shot can really show. So, you know, I have some very good golfers who I work with who we started to use that program with, and it really changed the way they see their practice and their skills. But, you know, I think there are definitely students who sometimes we have to explain what learning golf is really about. I mean, I worked really hard for a long time to become a good player, and I still compete pretty well, you know, in this area. I made it through the local qualifying for the U.S. Open this year. And, you know, so to be able to describe to somebody the process of what that kind of took, I use the analogy of a violinist. You know, if you listen to, if I were a violinist and you listen to me play, you know, a Vivaldi concerto and said, I want to learn that, the first thing I would probably say to you is, well, let's start with some scales. And this is what you have to do, and
right.
This is what you should practice for the next, you know, 5 days, and then you come back to me, and we're going to do this every week, and we'll probably continue that for a long time. And that's just sort of understood that that's what you would have to do to become a good violinist. But, you know, for some reason, people don't see a golf swing the same way when that's really what it is.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because, and that's true, that's very, very true, Paul. You know, one of the, I think the problems that most high handicapper amateur golfers tend to have is they come with a specific problem, whether it's slicing the ball, hooking, whatever the scenario happens to be, and they're looking for sort of a quick fix. But at the same time, they want to lower their scores. There's three or four other things that they want, but they feel that, you know, tackling this one issue is going to accomplish that. And a lot of times it's not, as you said, using the scenario of learning to play the violin, you know, there's a process that takes place. And I think people have to sort of do their own assessment, decide, what is it I really want?
Absolutely.
It just a matter of, do you know what I'm trying to say is, a lot of times I think that the and I think this is why, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, why so many of the amateurs really struggle out there is because their goal, they're not really setting goals. They're coming with a scenario and looking for a Band-Aid solution, a quick fix, if you will. And I think this is obviously very frustrating for those of us in the business because we know the truth, just as you've alluded to, that you have to be able to be willing to put in the time and the effort. And I know, as I'm sure you do, Paul, that you got some great guys up in the Jersey area. I've had a few of them on the show, Brian Dobby. I'm not sure if you're familiar with or not, but he's been on the program.
Yeah,
and a few others have been on the show, and I know just from some of the conversations that you guys have a pretty tight-knit group up there and obviously try to help one another and work together in many, many ways. And I think one of the things that has to really happen, I think, in the golf industry, particularly somehow we've got to get out to the public to understand that if they really want to improve and lower their scores, it's not a Band-Aid solution that's going to help. It's other things that have to be done. And I think people don't really understand that. And this is something I think that the industry really needs to focus a little bit more. And one of the questions I want to ask you, since we're on the topic of junior golf, obviously, you know, you've played competitive golf for quite some time, so you have an understanding of what it takes to do that. Explain for some of the junior golfers or parents of junior golfers that may be tuning into the program tonight, really what the process is to play competitive golf, what they can expect, because there's a lot of them out there that have never done that. They don't know what to expect. They just think, okay, well, my kid's a pretty good golfer, or I'm a pretty good little golfer, and I'm just going to go out there and compete. There's a lot more behind that. Explain a little bit some of the process that you had to go through to get where you are and what they can expect to be faced with some of the challenges and some of the pitfalls, if you will.
It is a huge process. I mean, I think in terms of just the financial commitment, you could probably liken it to youth hockey. There's a lot of equipment involved. There's greens fees, obviously, or belonging to a club. And those costs never really stop. So
no.
I was really lucky. I actually learned how to play at a public course, and the teacher who I worked with kind of took me under his wing, and I sort of worked off the books at his driving range all the way through high school, picking golf balls and, you know, learning how to grip clubs, and was able to play and practice for free basically until I went to college. But I don't think that scenario would really happen again.
No. I wish.
Right. So, yeah. It's extremely expensive. It's a big time commitment, I think, to develop the kinds of skills that you need to be competitive at a very high level. We're talking about, probably at least 3 or 4 times a week, kind of dedicated practice sessions, and playing golf on the weekends, traveling to tournaments as kids get older. I mean, I have 8, 9, 10-year-old students who travel around the tri-state area playing in U.S. Kids local events, and then going down to the World Championships. That's another cost, obviously a great opportunity, and,
sure.
And they're very happy to do that, but it definitely takes a lot of work, and I think you have to develop skills and work with. I think it's very helpful to work with one teacher who knows the child, who will be able to know them over hopefully a long period of time, and make sure that the golf swing, essentially stays as natural and normal without changing as possible. Because if you have a talented junior golfer who at 8 or 9 years old is showing promise, their golf swing doesn't need to be changed very much. That's really not, I don't think that's what it's really about, the coaching side of things.
Also, too, Paul, I think one thing that, and I really want to sort of instill this for some parents that might be tuning into the program as well, particularly the parents, and I've heard other pros say this, especially when working with some of the big clinics and that down in South Central Florida, that get a lot of students that come in, youngsters that want to play professional golf, and obviously have the financial resources, whether it be through their family or have some sort of sponsorship involved, and come in there. And there's a lot of pressure from the parents. How do we find a sort of happy medium, if you will, between what's good to sort of encourage and help and being a little bit too overbearing? How do we sort of balance that out? And you know, if little Johnny is a good golfer, but maybe there's a lot of pressure at home, and I don't want to say to perform, but, you know, a lot of anxiety sort of creeps up. How do you sort of keep the parents at bay without really offending them too much? And I think, I apologize.
Are you there?
Hi, Paul. I'm sorry. For some reason, the call got dropped. I was just in the middle. I don't know if you heard my question. I apologize for that. Somehow we got disconnected. What I was asking was let me just sort of try and do this a little quicker this time. One of the things that I've heard some feedback from other professionals, particularly in the South Central Florida area where we have some of the accomplished schools down there, a lot of juniors come there, and there's a lot of parents that obviously maybe have the financial resources to get their kids into these programs. And some of the feedback I've gotten is, and certainly not in every case, but sometimes there's a lot of pressure from the parents for these youngsters to perform. How do we sort of find a happy medium and balance? I mean, obviously they want the kid wants to play. The parents, you know, certainly want to encourage them, but sometimes maybe they're a little bit too, as I said, overbearing. So how do we sort of balance that out without really sort of offending the parents, but at the same time keeping little Johnny, who wants to play, focused on the tasks at hand?
That's a huge challenge for families, I would say. I have a pretty easygoing personality, and I think I work pretty well with parents for the most part. And I can't really think of a time when I had a problem, but I would say the challenge is that when you have a kid, a child who is 7 or 8, and they get into golf and they start becoming competitive, and then, you know, in the U.S. kids events, their parents caddy for them. Mm-hmm. The parent is basically, you know, trying to do the best they can to help their child and to sort of to coach them in a way during these events, but they're still the child's parent, and it's pretty hard to watch your child fail, and there's a lot of failure in golf.
Sure.
And so, you know, I think you have parents who end up getting very anxious, and a lot of them really don't, a lot of them don't have a lot of experience with golf. They may not even really play. And so
right.
It's very, very hard to relate. You know, if you've done other activities where there's a high rate of success, and, you know, good golfers can make golf look very easy. So if you're a parent and you see your child doing this very well on the range, and when you're practicing and then having a different experience when you're on the golf course during a tournament, you might not comprehend what that's about. And that's just normal, you know,
sure.
But I think that's where a lot of it comes from. You know, and a lot of the parents that I work with, the families that I work with are non-golfers. So it's a lot of just explaining what golf is like and what tournament golf is like, and the fact that nerves definitely come into play, and that really is why tournament golf is a different kind of thing, like Bobby Jones said. So I think it's challenging because it's a resource-intensive activity. Parents aren't going to hire a caddy most of the time for an 8 or 9 year old student, or, you know, a junior golfer, and they want to be there to support them. So I think that's a lot of it.
I think also too, Paul, one of the things that is important, especially when you're dealing at that age with the youngsters, is I think that the parents also have to. It's not just a matter of, you know, a lot of these kids, they'll see somebody on TV that's playing. You know, for a long time, we heard a lot of kids got excited, you know, when Tiger was in his prime, and everybody got excited, and they wanted to be the next Tiger Woods. There obviously has to be a realistic approach in some of these discussions. I think the child obviously has to, and that doesn't mean that with some hard work that they can't possibly make it out there one day. But the parents also have to be realistic. And sometimes, again, there's challenges there. They see that their youngster plays very well in a lot of different events, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to make it. I mean, you know, one in, I'm not sure what the numbers are, but, you know, one in a million, if you will, actually makes it out onto the PGA or LPGA tours and respectively. And, you know, sometimes there's a lot of tough roads that have to be challenged. And again, that's where we have to sort of come in and guide and certainly don't want to, you know, squash any dreams. But at the same time, we have to be realistic and make sure that the parents are realistic in their approach, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Definitely. I think it was very important. I knew that I had to have a good education and that I had to be a good student while I was striving for that other goal of being a professional golfer. You know, it is extremely important. A stat that I like to use to kind of help give that a little bit of perspective is that there are 7 American players born every year who will play for longer than 3 years on the PGA Tour. So that's, you know, we're talking about if you play for longer than 3 years, you're probably going to make a decent living and you know, your investment in all of those hours that you spent working toward that goal will have, you know, turned out for something substantial. But that's not a lot of people.
Right. So, that's very, very low, yeah. when you look at the grand scheme of the population. That's for sure. Let me ask you about, because you mentioned it earlier briefly, but I want to get you to talk a little bit more about it. Obviously, technology is a big driving force here the last 10 years in golf, particularly in golf instruction. FlightScope and all kinds of different simulators are available out there now. How do you balance some of the technology? Obviously, technology is good and you want to be able to use it, and I'm certainly a big proponent of it. But I also like to be a little bit cautious that we don't become too reliant or self-reliant on technology and that we sort of stick to what we've learned in the process along the way as professionals. So how do you find balance with the technology that you're using? Tell us a little bit about some of the stuff that you do use first off, and then how you sort of balance it out with your students.
So if we're talking about like hardware, I use a FlightScope X2 and a BodyTrack pressure mat. I think of shot-by-shot as technology, even though it's not really the same thing. But I use that. And when a student can do it, because there is a process to that.
Sure.
You know, when somebody can do it, it's tremendously beneficial. And there's a reason, I think, that Zach Johnson and some other players on the PGA Tour have continued to use it. You know, I think, get back to your question, you have to be very, very careful with it and use it with discretion. And, you know, I would say most of the time my clients get very little of the information that's pure data.
Right.
You know, I think that's the best way to describe it. We're using it to, in a lot of cases, prove improvement. So if I'm using a BodyTrack and a FlightScope and I'm able to show a student how to move their weight the proper way for the first time and they hit the ball 25 yards further than they thought was even possible, then it's right there. It's, you know, we have a very reliable piece of equipment that shows it, you know, and we have the BodyTrack data that, you know, you can explain, you know, how that happened with. And I guess that's the best way that I can describe how I try to use it. I try to really keep it as straightforward as I can.
Yeah. And I like that approach as well. I've been a big proponent, you know, certainly those that have tuned into the program have heard me talk about technology, both good and bad. I think technology is certainly going to be here to stay. There's no doubt about it. And I'm sure, Paul, you know, this day and age being on social media, you see all kinds of conversations about different equipment. One of the things that I've always, some of them can be a little heated at times,
And well, it's a big debate in golf right now. It's,
sure. I guess my position is this. I sort of think along the same lines as you. I think there is certainly a place for technology, but I think you put it quite eloquently in the sense that a lot of the raw data that's coming back is really something that we as instructors use for our own information, if you will. I think one of the problems that I've seen and heard with some of the industry discussions is there are some that are relying so heavily on the technology and getting caught up in the figures and the facts and so on and so forth that they're kind of missing an opportunity to really understand what the person's doing. They're going solely by the numbers, and then they're relaying that information to their students, which further confuses. And the reason why I know that is because I've actually had people that have written into the program who've actually been on both sides, student and teacher, and some of the students that have gotten too much information data is just overwhelming. It's confusing because they're not trained, obviously, on the equipment as most of the instructors are nowadays, and sure. They don't understand it. So when I ask this is why I say, you know, how do we find a balance? And I've used this phrase many, many times on the show. You know, there comes a point in time when the batteries die or the power goes out and that technology is not there. We need to make sure that we're well-versed in our craft, if you will, in the event that should ever happen. So how do we find balance as instructors that we make sure that we don't get too self-absorbed in the technology and that we don't, get the students as well too involved in all the numbers? How do we make sure we keep that healthy balance?
I think that's a very important question for golf instruction. I would say I try to remember that for the most part students are there for results and probably because they like being around you to some degree. And, you have to have a connection with your student. You can't just be somebody who relays raw data. And the longer I teach with a flight scope and a body track, the less I feel like I need it. And I think that's because I'm learning things from using it that, you know, allow me to see teaching, see students, see golf swings in a different way. And you really shouldn't need the machines. I feel like they're really more educational,
right,
in a way. So I think that if you take that approach, then I think you're going to be okay when the lights go out, so to speak, or when the batteries die. I try not to get into the details because you can see pretty quickly when a student gets overwhelmed. And you really don't ever want to be at that point in the lesson and have it be because you gave them all of that information.
Right. And the reason why I say that, Paul, is, and I like to get, feedback from others as well. I think it's interesting, different perspectives and different ideas out there. And that's really the whole purpose of doing a program like this. The reason why I say that is I've actually had comments sent in or discussions where students have gone to, and taken lessons with instructors, and the instructor doesn't even look up from the equipment. And
really?
that's where the danger comes in my opinion. And that's why I'm a big proponent of it. It's there as a tool, as an assistant, if you will. It's almost like having a partner, if you will, in what you're doing. It's there to provide you certain data. And to confirm, as you said, but I think one of the things that we're seeing, and I think the industry is starting to recognize this, pardon me, is that there are some that are becoming too self-reliant. And I think it's more, and again, not to pick on anybody, I think it's more some of the younger, more junior instructors that are coming out because that's sort of how they're engineered, if you will. And I think some of the older, more seasoned golf professionals out there recognize that it is a tool that certainly can help and be beneficial, but we can't get so self-absorbed in it that it overtakes and overshadows good golf instruction. I think you have to be a good instructor first, And then obviously have equipment there to support and be supportive of what it is that you're trying to instill in the student's mind.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And I think, you know, people are also, you know, we live in a very quickly, I would say, you know, changing technological world, and people are learning from technology now, and our attention spans are getting shorter, and, you know, it helps to have these kinds of things to engage people.
Sure.
I taught all winter last year at a simulator facility that had private simulator rooms, and they're very nice sims, and people said that my students said that they got a ton out of it. And it was kind of surprising to me in a way, because I had a flight scope and I taught outdoors. And in many cases, my students felt like they were getting more working on their golf swing on a simulator, getting more from that experience. So it's definitely a double-edged sword, but you have to, you know, take the good with the bad, I guess.
Well, and there's, I think the other thing too is, and I'm sure this has become part of the frustration in the industry a little bit, is that there is a lot of constant changing and updating in the technology. So you just sort of nicely get used to one philosophy, if you will, and the next PGA show that you go to, there's two or three other things that have come out,
sure,
you know, bigger and better and so forth. So it's a constant, again, sort of reevaluation as an instructor. Let's shift gears just a little bit. And speaking of equipment and things like that, you obviously do some putting instruction with Seymour Putters. In fact, you're one of the leading instructors for Seymour Putter Institute, and have repped for them a number of times throughout the years on tour. Tell us a little bit about Seymour Putters and a little bit about the program there.
Yeah, I started teaching a fair amount of putting probably 3 years ago. And by that being, you know, pretty relatively high percentage of my business. And I started using a Seymour because I mentioned that I, you know, play and compete, and I qualified for the Met Open. I think it was 2012, and played very well to get in, shot 68. And then 3 weeks later went to the tournament and couldn't get a ball started online, and really, you know, couldn't solve that problem for myself, you know, within the span of the 2 days that I was there. So I ended up going to the putter because I knew about it. I knew about Zach Johnson and Payne Stewart, and had actually experimented with it a little bit when I was in college, and worked really hard, learned the system, and talked to some of the people at the company and became involved with it. And it's, I think some of the things that plague golfers in general, the putter can really help. And even if you end up just using it as a training aid, which a lot of great players still do who don't play the putter, like Patrick Harrington and some other players on tour, you know, you get a lot from it. One of the real problems with average golfers is that they have a tremendous amount of face rotation in their putting stroke. And if you work with the Seymour, they also generally don't have very consistent ball position. So if you work with the Seymour, those are two of the main things that you learn very quickly. If, you know, you're fitted for the putter, it basically becomes, in a way, your putting teacher if you practice with it. So alignment, hand position, eye position, ball position, face rotation, you know, those are all things that this club can help you with. So it's helped me tremendously. I was not, I would say, a naturally good putter. I was a very good ball striker, and, you know, still, I would still consider that my strength. You know, not a great putter, but I have helped myself become a much more consistent putter, and I feel like I can make a lot of putts sometimes now, and that's a big reason why, I would say.
So that's obviously it's helped you personally, so it enabled you to be able to sort of relay that out to some of your students. You know, one of the things, Paul, I think that that again, sort of keeping on this theme with some of the amateurs out there, and I touched on it a little bit earlier, and I want to get into it a little bit more now, if we can. I think one of the problems that a lot of the amateurs have is they focus so much on, you know, wanting to be able to hit the ball straight and wanting to, you know, hit those, you know, 250 to 300 yard drives, and they really neglect their short game. Do you have anything specific that you put in play at Forest Gate or some of the other areas that you work in order to encourage your students and players that you work with to focus more? Obviously, some of the better players understand this, but some of your higher handicappers or maybe some of your members there at the club that still struggle with high handicaps, what are some of the things that you do to try and get them to focus on really where the scoring is, and that's that 100 yards in? What do you do to try and encourage them to do that?
I think if you use a stats program of any kind, it's going to show you that most amateur golfers don't hit a lot of greens in regulation. And if you look at the stats, I tell a lot of people, you know, an average golfer, 16 handicapper, this data can, you know, out there and available, hits about 4 greens around. A 4 handicapper is going to hit maybe 8 greens around. So for you, I mean, we right now don't have a wedge range or anything, if that's what you're kind of alluding to in terms of like a physical, facility to encourage short game practice. But I talk about it all the time with the people I work with that, you know, if you want to maintain your momentum on the golf course and feel good about getting the ball up and down and not letting mistakes bog you down, that your short game is basically your insurance policy. If a 4 handicap only hits 8 greens around, 4 handicaps work hard on their game. Took them a long time to get to the place where they can hit 8 greens or 9 greens around. So it's a skill that doesn't take nearly as much work, and you can get a lot of satisfaction from it. And it's probably why I'm, you know, still competitive for sure. So I guess that's the best way to put it. It's about education, I think.
Yeah, and you know, as we were talking a little bit earlier about some of the juniors out there, and you had mentioned about, you know, getting them to practice a little bit more. This is something too that I think a lot of the, especially the higher handicappers out there, and whether it's, you know, time restraints or just not having maybe a full access to a good facility, just don't have or spend the time practicing, and they wonder why. And this is going to go into a question a little bit later, but you know, this is something that a lot of the golfers out there still struggle with, is making that commitment. And I don't want to misunderstand when I say this. I don't want people that are tuning into the program thinking that you have to go out and spend every waking moment out on the driving range or a practice tee or what have you, or even the putting green. But you have to be willing, if you want your game to improve, that the cold hard fact of it is, and again, the stats support it, is you have to be willing to make a reasonable commitment, again, depending on what your expectations are. If you have very high expectations, then you better be prepared to make sure that you have realistic a practice regimen, if you will, set up. And if you're somebody that just wants to get out there once in a while and play, well, then obviously, you know, you have a different set of goals. But this is something that's really sort of plagued, I think, golfers for a long time, is they just seem to, again, as I mentioned earlier, looking for Band-Aid solutions to some of the problems, and it's just not going to happen. So it's a matter of, like you said, really educating the golfers out there and saying, hey, here are things that you need to work on that are certainly have proven, have time-tested, proved that they will yield success, but you have to be willing to do it. So for those that don't have a lot of time, what are some things that you encourage your golfers to do when they don't have a lot of time to make the best use of what time they do have?
I think in general, practicing with a specific purpose, no matter what you're doing, you don't have to have a ton of time, you know, I can have a pretty effective full swing practice session in a half an hour. I feel like a lot of times, but you have to do things in a way that are going to allow you to measure your progress, see where you are. So, you know, hitting balls just randomly and, you know, to the same target without counting them or trying to determine how well you're doing is not an effective way of practicing golf. You know, we have all kinds of different shots that you have to play during a round of golf. If you go to the range and you hit a 7-iron to the 150 flag, and then, you know, you go out on the golf course and you don't understand why that skill isn't transferring, it's because there are a lot of, you know, you're not going to have that shot that often, you know.
So right, there's a lot of there's a lot of variables when you get out in the golf course.
Sure, exactly. So, you know, having students compete with themselves, you know, if you practice at the same range, you know, most of the time, you're going to have little fairways that you can create between targets. You're going to have target greens that you can use, and you maybe take 10 balls out and see how many out of 10 you get on that green from whatever the distance is. And you're introducing a kind of an aspect of competition, and you can track that and see how you're doing over time. And then you increase it to 20 balls, or you make your target smaller. Or you can do the same thing with a driver and try to fit in a certain number of balls in between two targets, like it's a fairway. Golf is such a game of confidence that if you can do things like that and get 7 out of 10 balls in the fairway, you're going to feel pretty good. And
sure,
you'll feel like you got something out of that session, even if you didn't really spend very much time. And that's because you were focusing on golf skills. You weren't focusing on just making perfect swings, which is, you know, not really a tangible goal. So, you know, that I think if we're talking about how to practice on the range, that's definitely, you know, that would be up there in terms of how to do that in a, you know, time efficient way. At home, depending on what your swing issues are, there are lots of things that you can do at home to fix your golf swing. So if I have a student who, you know, tends to move their head a fair amount, there are drills that I can have them do at home that are going to help them achieve that goal probably more quickly than if they were hitting golf balls.
What I was going to say was, just before I lost my thought, that's something that I'm a big proponent of. You know, growing up as a youngster in that, obviously, you know, you don't always have an opportunity to get out to the golf course. And something that my father had always instilled in me when he was first sort of introducing me to the game was that there were things that I can do away from the golf course that can help. And one of the things that he used to do, and I still use it to this day, I've got a full-length mirror literally from floor to ceiling. And I'll actually stand in front of the mirror in my golf posture, if you will, and I will actually work on certain things. I have enough room. I could actually swing much more than a 7-iron. Now, obviously, some people can't do that. And there's equipment or tools out there that are what I would call club simulators, short clubs, things like that. Or you can even get an old club and cut it down if you're worried about nicking the ceiling and you know, heading to the divorce lawyer for damaging your,
right,
your house. But
my,
you know,
parents couldn't divorce me growing up, but I broke a lot of lamps in our house. So
exactly. But, you know, all kidding aside, but really what I try to do is I try to utilize, you know, that idea, if you will, that sometimes, especially, you know, if you look outside and it's raining or it's terrible weather and you just can't get out there, or maybe you only have 15 or 20 minutes, there are things that you can do in your house. If you've got a carpet, you can practice a little bit of putting. Of course, it's not going to simulate exactly as the green, but it still gives you that little bit of feel. And there's a lot of things that you can do. There's all kinds of things that you can do as well. And obviously, fitness comes into play. There's certain things that you can do to keep yourself
absolutely
in shape and keeping yourself flexible. It's not just a matter of lifting weight. So these are things that we can do. And this is really sort of the direction I was going tonight, is I wanted to talk about and lead up to this question. There's two things that we're going to talk about here as we close up. One is what I would call the negative, and one's the positive. The negative, as I mentioned earlier, is about handicap. This is something that has really, in my opinion, plagued the golf industry for many, many years. Despite all of the advancements, all the technology, all of the great instruction out there, handicaps really have not come down with any significance. Your opinion, why do you think that is, and what can we do in the industry as a whole? What can we do to try and change that? What are things that we maybe aren't doing now that we should be doing? First off, in your opinion, why do you think that's happening?
I think it's a combination of things, probably. I think I don't think that a lot of people report their scores. I think that a lot of people, I mean they don't really have handicaps, and it's just hard to monitor that. Hard to monitor golf improvement if people aren't doing that. I think the courses have gotten harder as golf equipment has improved and the ball's gotten hotter, and I think, you know, clubs in general, the driver has gotten a lot easier to hit. I had a student who brought a persimmon driver to a lesson the other day, and I hit it, and it was fun, but it wasn't how I would want to play golf right now.
Sure.
You know, I would say that the equipment's gotten better, but the course conditions have gotten better and in a lot of cases harder. So that it's balanced itself out in a way. I think that, you know, golf instruction is very good, and there, you know, there are a lot of wonderful teachers out there, and there's a lot of great technology. But I think we need to help golfers understand that going to take a lesson in and of itself doesn't necessarily mean improvement.
Right. Right.
And that's kind of, you know, that's the process that I, you know, experience a lot with my students and trying to educate them about motor learning and you know, just the way good golfers become good golfers. So I guess that's the best answer I can give you, Ted.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that it's, you know, as we've been talking about here, you know, obviously some of the younger players or some of the players that are have a little more competitive juice, if you will, they're willing to put in the time and the effort. I think it really adds up to a couple of things that you've already mentioned, and then maybe a few more. Number one, I think obviously, even though the equipment and technology has advanced, as you indicated, the courses have become more difficult. They've expanded for several years now. They've gotten longer, and unfortunately, as you said, it's kind of balanced it out. So, had things stayed the same with the equipment changes, I think you would have seen some improvement. But also, too, I think that there have been a lot of time restrictions. People just don't have, for instance, you know, you used to see certain days where you would see a big influx of golfers out there. I've gone by many, many courses over the last several years, and it's not just related to the recession. That certainly has bogged some of it down. Obviously, we know that. But even before that, I think people's time restriction, there's other obligations, family obligations. Golf has taken on a different dynamic, if you will.
I think there's
also people that, and we have to be honest in this industry, and that's one of the things that I always try to be as honest as I can. I think that there has been a lot of frustration. I've heard it. I'm sure you've heard it yourself. Despite all the changes and the great instructors out there, people are not seeing the results, and they're not understanding what to do with all of this information that they're receiving. And as a result, they become frustrated, and they're dropping out of the game. And accessibility. Courses have expanded, have gotten great in some ways, but they've also, in some cases, become more expensive. So then, you know, that hits the pocketbook. So there's a lot of factors that play into this.
Yeah, I think, I really do believe that America has kind of changed in the last 5 or 6 years, and people just don't have a lot of time anymore. And golf, we have to kind of figure out a way to make this compatible with those changes, because families just don't have the same amount of time. And I, you know, I think it's, it does take a lot of time and dedication to become a good golfer. But we have to make it engaging and something that people actually really want to do, because we're competing with cell phones and a lot of stuff out there that is pretty engaging on its own. So I think that's one of the big battles that we've got to face right now.
Right. And one of the other things too, Paul, I think that really people overlook, I mean, certainly the technology outside of the golf industry, cell phones, you said, you've got social media and that came. I think one of the things that's been a byproduct of some of the changes in golf, even though that was not the intent, is because it has become more difficult for the masses. And I'm not talking about the high, you know, the high-level players and that, or the low handicap players, but certainly some of the, you know, men and women that have come into golf here in the last, I'll say, even decade, is it's become so difficult in some ways for them. And again, having limited time, that it's taken the fun. You know, golf should always be fun. First and foremost, forgetting about how well you play, whether you're, you know, in a 4 handicap, a scratch golfer, or a 25 handicap, you need to go out and have fun. And I think a lot of people have become frustrated over the years in trying to improve with the game. They've gone out and they've spent $400 on a new driver. They've got new clubs. They've taken multiple lessons. They're not seeing results for whatever the reasons are. And that's not a criticism against the instructors, but it's just they're not seeing it. And as a result, they're not having fun. And I think that that's something that what I've seen here and the danger that I've seen here of late, and I understand part of it, again, stems from the recession. One of the things that I would caution some of these courses, obviously country clubs and things are a little bit different, but some of the resort courses are sort of just discounting and slashing their pricing so much through discount programs that they're not making money and they're going out of business as a way to entice people to come back in. And I'm not saying that, you know, isn't a time and place for that, but I think that it's gotten so much so that it's actually hurt their bottom line, and that's not really what the people want. People want to be able to come out and play and have a good time and have a good experience, and they're just not doing that. So there's something missing. There's a piece of the puzzle that's missing that for some reason the industry just has not tapped into. They're starting to, I think, with some of the new initiatives that they're coming out with. And I think it has to kind of do like what Las Vegas did a number of years ago, and unfortunately they've changed back to their old ways, is they tried to make it into a family center, if you will. Now, Vegas is a little different beast. Golf has to do that as well. Golf has to embrace it as a family, not just, you know, dad because he was a golfer and not just mom and dad because they're golf. They need to get everybody, the whole family involved. And that's really, I think, what people are looking for. They're looking for a family experience. And then as time goes on and people get a little bit older and mature, if they want to pursue it on an individual basis, then that's something they can do. But I think it has to be geared for a family experience, especially with the resorts. Would you agree with that, do you think?
Absolutely. I was actually, when I first came back to the golf business, I was the director of golf at a public facility. I was an assistant pro basically for a couple of months, and then I became the director of golf. And so I lived that kind of experience for a little while, for a couple of years, where, you know, we had to compete price-wise, and it was, you know, it's a challenging market. But you can't devalue your, I mean, that is your value. As soon as you bring your prices down, you're telling people that that's what your experience is worth. And and that's not accurate, you know. So if you're a good golf course and you spend a certain amount on maintenance and all the things that go into running a facility, and then you lower your price dramatically, then that's the message I think that you're sending. And there are definitely, you know, some big challenges, because golf has to compete with sports that are much more established with young kids.
Yep.
And the way you get the family to the golf course on the weekends is to get them away from soccer and basketball and swimming I mean, and not to say that we're trying to get them away, but we have to, that's what we're, we have to compete with those sports. And traditionally, kids are getting involved in those sports at much younger ages than they're getting involved in golf. And so when they become serious about swimming or soccer by age 8 or 9, or even earlier, it's going to be much harder to get them into golf when they're just getting into golf at that age.
Right. And one of the, yeah, and one of the criticisms, too, that I've heard, and I'm sure you've probably heard similar, and this is something that I know that there's been a lot of initiatives through some of the junior programs, that is golf obviously has a little bit of a disadvantage to some of the other sports that you mentioned. It is a more expensive sport to get into than, say, soccer or tennis or what have you, because the equipment. So I know there's a lot of good initiatives out there to get that equipment made available for some of the junior golfers and that. But
yeah, that's not even really an issue anymore, I don't think. I mean, I think U.S. Kids Golf does that
exactly
very, very well. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, yeah, there's others out there as well. So that was something that for a while it was a little bit of a challenge. But now they're with U.S. Kids and as I said, some of the other ones out there, there's other initiatives that have happened that have helped
sure
make that a little bit more affordable. But I just think that that's a target. And I think something, too, that you had mentioned and that we discussed briefly about is, again, with the technology, with social media and that, has been a huge distraction with this next generation. Obviously, golfers like myself that are the 50 and up market, I mean, we're pretty much, if we've been golfing for years, you know, we're pretty much going to continue to play golf, maybe not as much in some cases, but we're still going to play it. But that new generation that's coming up, there are so many things that are competing for their attention, and golf is just not something that's in there. So that's something, too, that I think the industry really needs to take a look at, and getting into what I've said, and I know there are some programs out there. I mean, First Tee is a great program, that, but I think they need to do as some of the other sports have and get into the school curriculum somehow more involved in there. And I know there are some programs that are doing that very effectively, but I think this is where some serious dollars need to be spent with the golf industry in doing that. And that's just a thought, but I think if they get into more of the schools, and I'm not talking colleges or even high school, I'm talking into the elementary and middle schools, get more access there, I think that you'll see
yeah
kids take a certain percentage anyways will take an interest in golf.
I agree. The New Jersey Golf Foundation supports a golf in schools program that sends pros into schools in the wintertime to do that. So I think it's, definitely needs to be done. There are a couple of organizations that focus on that, that run, golf teaching programs in schools. But yeah, I don't think that kids are getting the exposure, like you said, until much later, and it's usually going to be because of dad,
sure,
in fewer cases, mom, I would say.
Right.
And those are just the demographics of the way, what the game has been. So, but yeah, I think golf is fun. I think kids have fun playing golf. I see it every day.
Sure.
I just think it's more the fact that, we have to figure out a way to reach them. And that effort is just seeming to be seeming like that's just getting started right now,
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where I see really the true growth and development. I think getting it into the family environment, making it fun, getting the parents, especially when the kids are at a very early age, getting them engaged in golf. And even if, as I said, little Johnny doesn't necessarily want to play on the PGA Tour, but just something that he can use for fun along the way, or maybe even becomes a business tool for him or for a young lady as well. There's a lot of women that are doing some great initiatives through the LPGA right now and elsewhere in getting those programs out there to get women engaged in golf programs and using
yep
it as an effective business tool. So there's a lot of things happening. I just like to see it, I guess, ramped up a little bit more than what it is. Paul, let me just sort of shift one more final time here, and then I'll give you an opportunity as we close out here in a little bit just to reiterate where it is you are and if people are interested in getting in touch with you and that. As I mentioned, it was sort of a negative and a positive. The positive is, obviously, with recent U.S. Open, young Jordan Spieth, of course, has done extremely well. He's got two majors under his belt this year. working towards a third, I'm sure. My question is to you is this. Will we see some of the veteran players like a Jim Furyk and some of the others, a Mickelson, and even Tiger, will we see some of them back sort of in the lead again, or is this becoming a young guns game? And the reason why I ask that question is it just seems that, and I have a theory, and I'm going to lay that out here in just a second, but I want to get your thoughts on it. We're seeing a younger generation that's playing on the PGA Tour and even the LPGA Tour that are coming out. Some of them might all have only won one or two times. We're not seeing as much consistency with some of the veterans any longer, and I have some theories on that. I just wanted to get your thoughts on it.
I think the game's gotten really competitive, much more competitive than it was 20 years ago. I think as players age, their kids get older, they have more
sure.
reasons to kind of focus on family and maybe not be as interested in golf or you know, working hard on their games, and that's just understandable. And I think, you know, we look at Jordan Spieth and Ricky Fowler and some of these young players, and they're just, you know, they're athletes, and they're working really, really hard, and they've got plenty of energy. So
yeah.
I think that's just the way of the world. As long as I've been around golf and watched it, that's kind of seems the way it's happened, you know.
So in other words, us old guys haven't got a chance anymore. Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, I think I probably have about 5 years left before. I mean, I like to play and I like to compete, but I know that, you know, there's definitely a time limit in your life as a competitive golfer where you know you're going to have a hard time playing with kids who are 20, 21, playing golf full-time, whether it's in college or otherwise. So, you know, I think that's just the way the tour is. And it's fun to watch Jordan play, and I think he's got he's kind of a new brand of golfer. You know, he was a multi-sport athlete and didn't specialize. And, you know, I'm a Titleist Performance Institute certified professional, and that's one of the things that TPI really promotes is having a well-rounded athletic background as a support for your golf. And I believe that. And it looks like Rory may have given him a little extra room here headed into the British Open with his Achilles
right.
heel injury. So.
Well, he certainly got a couple of great tournaments under his belt, and is certainly going to give him some momentum. And I think you're exactly right in your analogy. I think that you know, as the golfers sort of, and I'm just using them as an example, but the Mickelsons and the Furyks and some of the other golfers that have been on tour for a while, I think their priorities do change. I think there's a lot of truth that obviously their energy levels aren't quite the same as a Jordan or a Rory or Ricky Fowler. So that certainly plays into part of it. But also, too, I think their priorities change. I think as they get older and their families get older, they don't have that same drive, if you will. That doesn't mean that they don't want to get out there and play golf. But as Nicholas said, to some degree, Freddie Couples made this comment, I think, a few years ago, is there comes a point in time where your priorities in life change. You don't have sort of that same hunger. And I think this is something, too, that why a lot of people are looking at Tiger Woods right now, as he's starting to get to that age limit as well. It's not that they don't have an ability or a great golf game, but that drive, if you will, the momentum sort of shifts a little bit. And some of the younger players who, even though they're all making good money on the PGA Tour, there's a different kind of hunger, if you will, as a youngster when they come out fresh, you know, out of Q school or what have you, or off of mini tours. And I think some of these more seasoned veterans. So I don't think that doesn't mean that they're never going to win again, but I don't think you're going to see even Tiger Woods. I'd be very, very surprised if Tiger Woods came back. It's certainly not going to be like he was in the early 2000s, but I don't think you're going to see somebody at his age level come back and really sort of clean up on the tour. I think you're going to see more of, of a Jordan type player out there who's going to come up and, you know, get a few tournaments, and then somebody else is going to come in. I don't think you're going to see a real dominant player as much anymore.
I think, it's entirely possible that we may see it. You know, Jordan Spieth, could win the British Open. And, you know, golf is a momentum game. You know, you roll on that confidence and you're only as good as you believe you are.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you never really do know. He's a pretty extraordinary athlete. And I think that was a lot of what we saw with Tiger when he was younger. You know, he won 3 U.S. junior amateurs in a row and then 3 U.S. amateurs in a row. And it just seemed like he couldn't everything happened in the proper order for him to have as much confidence as he could possibly have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why he ended up dominating the way he did for as long as he did. It wasn't necessarily because he was the greatest ball striker. You know, we all know that he's, you know.
Sure.
And then things happened that, you know, affected his confidence, obviously, I think. So, you know, I don't think that, I wouldn't rule out the possibility of somebody being dominant again, but it's so deep. The field, you know, the fields are so deep, the sport's so deep now that
right.
I think it'll be harder. And so, yeah.
Well, and you know, the other thing too is, I say this not as a negative, but I think the younger players have a certain cockiness and almost an arrogance. When they're coming out, you know, they just believe that they're infallible and they're going to win everything when they come out here. And I think as the older players get a little bit more seasoned, they become a little bit more realistic and they understand that it's a lot tougher out there. So I think when you come with that energy and that come, and again, when I say cockiness and arrogance, I don't mean it in a derogatory way, but I think you come in with, you know, sort of rose-colored glasses. And, you know, I had the pleasure here over the last, this past year on my other show, The Women of Golf, that I co-host with Cindy Miller every Tuesday morning. And we've had the pleasure here, especially over the last 6 or 7 months, of interviewing some great young ladies off the Symetra Tour. And, you know, there's a whole different mindset when you talk to some of these young up-and-coming players. Some of them have played for a year or two. Some of them have played for maybe 4 or 5 years. It's very interesting, the mindset, and as you said, there's just a certain energy that comes with these younger players that you don't see in some of the older players. And also, too, there's time, not just family, but some of the older players get more involved in outside things, whether it be foundations,
sure.
Golf tournaments that are for charity, like Ernie Els. We talked about last week with Jack Barrett when he was on here. Els for Autism, of course, his young boy Ben, of course, has autism. So he's very involved in a lot of charity work and things like that, where some of these younger players haven't quite got to that level. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Jordan and some of the other young guys on there, but always makes it exciting. And you know, for us older guys that are still kicking around the can, as it were, we're going to do our best to roll some putts in and make it challenging. But it certainly, in some ways, it's a younger man's sport, if you will. As we wrap up here, Paul, I know that you mentioned you've been playing some competitive golf there up in New Jersey and that. are you going to try and get out quite a bit this year?
I've been playing a fair amount. I made it through the local qualifier for the U.S. Open here, shot 69. At Montami to get through, and then played up at in Westchester in the sectional, and didn't play that well, but that's just kind of life these days. You know, when you teach full time,
right.
You kind of show up at the golf course and you have it or you don't, you know. and I think I've played almost a tournament every week this season, which I really enjoy. I think it helps me stay in touch with competitive golf and, you know, coaching a fair number of competitive juniors, I think that helps me a great deal with that. I qualified for the New Jersey Open, so I'll be playing that next week. And then hopefully, I wasn't able to play in the Met Open last year. I had an injury, so I'm hoping that I can qualify for that and, you know, finish the year out, you know, with some New Jersey PGA events. So really enjoy playing competitively. It's an interesting balance to try to strike teaching full time and then basically, you know, playing maybe your only 18 hole round of the week is a tournament on Monday. But it's so much fun. I get to meet new people and people from around our section and play some really wonderful golf courses. I've played Ridgewood Country Club, Plainfield Country Club, White Beaches Country Club this past Monday, where Jim McGovern's the head pro. So it's a real treat.
Well, and you know, it's interesting that you made the comment about it's a sometimes difficult to strike that balance as a teacher professional to be able to get out and play. I know a lot of the other pros that I've had on the show over the last few years, it is difficult sometimes to find that balance because you get so involved in what you're doing day to day that sometimes it's just difficult to get out there. So obviously you found a formula, if you will, to sort of find a happy balance. I mean, you want to continue to play golf and play competitively, but at the same time you want to be able to continue to hone your craft that you're working on and help some other not just youngsters, but other players out there improve their game, and I'm sure that they're very grateful for that. Paul, as we wrap up, just let the folks know again if they're interested in connecting with you and learning about how to play some great golf that we all enjoy. How can they go about doing that? And let's go from there.
Sure. Again, I'm the director of instruction at Forest Gate Country Club. We're located in Monroe Township. You can also find me online at paulcastergolf.com and reach me at paulcaster@gmail.com if you'd like to send me an email. There is a phone number on the website as well. But thank you again, Ted, for having me. I appreciate it, and I really enjoyed it.
Perfect. And thank you, Paul, and just keep doing all the great work that you're doing up there in the Northeast. And if you happen to make it down into the Florida area at some point, let me know and we'll try to connect, you know, here when we can. But appreciate all the hard work that you do and up in New Jersey. And please say hello to some of the other pros up there. Brian, of course,
I
know quite well. And encourage them to come on the show. I would love to have some more. I've enjoyed having a number of pros from the New Jersey area. A lot of great section up in that area. You guys do phenomenal work. And as I said, I've had a few of them reach out. So I would love to have some more come on here from that area as well and share some great insight about what they're doing to help grow the game. But thank you for all of the hard work that you do, Paul, and much continued success. And good luck in some of your upcoming tournaments. Knock them stiff, and more importantly, roll them in the hole quick. But thank you for joining me. And Paul, I can't remember if I had already sent this to you or not. I know we discussed it, but if not, I'll send it out to you, a schedule for the Coach's Corner. I'd love to have you participate in some of the Coach's Corner panel discussions here coming up over the next few months. If you're available, that would be great. And
yeah,
we'd love
great.
To have you participate that as well. So I'll send it out to you and you can select some dates that you're available. But again, Paul, thank you very much for joining me tonight on Golf Talk Live. Enjoy the discussion here. And I certainly would love to have you come back anytime.
Thank you very much, Ted. I really enjoyed it too. And I will look forward to being back on the coaches panel and otherwise.
Okay. Sounds good. Paul, have a great weekend and we'll talk soon.
Thanks. You too. Take care, Ted.
All right. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, that was my very special guest, Paul Caster, of course, the director of instruction at Forest Gate Country Club up in Monroe, New Jersey. Very interesting discussion. Obviously, somebody that enjoys not only teaching this great game, but also enjoys playing as well. So I want to wish him, again, much continued success on both areas of golf. And again, thank you for joining me here tonight on Golf Talk Live. I enjoyed our discussion. And just to remind everybody, next week we will not have either of the programs, Golf Talk Live and or the Women of Golf with Cindy Miller and I. We'll not be broadcast next week. We're going to be taking a little bit break. I'm going on a short vacation, and Cindy's got some things going on her end as well. So we're going to take a little bit of break next week, next Tuesday and Thursday, respectively. But we will be back here, I believe it's the 21st and the 23rd, for both of the programs. So make sure that you come back and join us. Thank you very much. And in the meantime, while I'm off doing other things, you can go through and listen to some of the previously aired broadcasts by going to blogtalkradio.com /Golf Talk Live, or just type Golf Talk Live up in the search key, or the Women of Golf for that matter, if you want to listen to some of the great discussions that Cindy and I have had with some of the Symetra Tour players and some other great people in the golf industry as well, and some great ladies from the Legends Tour. If you go to blogtalkradio.com and type in either Women of Golf or Golf Talk Live up in the search key, you'll get to either or page, and just scroll down into the on-demand section, and you can listen to any of your shows that you may have missed, or again, you can re-listen to a program if you enjoyed that particular evening's conversation. But I want to thank just a number of people here that have continually supported me through this show with some great words and just great support as well. So let me just do that, and then, of course, I want to thank you guys. I want to thank particularly Mr. Jonathan Laird, who is the editor and owner of South Coast Golf Guide. I've mentioned him several times on the program. He's actually been on the show a few times. Has a great publication here in the southeastern part of the United States, virtually from Texas right over here to the northwest part of Florida and all states in between. Pardon me. And just a great publication. Features a number of great courses throughout as I said, the several states here in the southeast, and it's been around, I believe this is his 21st year, if I'm not mistaken, but a great publication. So if you're interested in getting a copy of the South Coast Golf Guide, go to southcoastgolfguide.com, and you can request a copy if you don't happen to be in the area. But if you are coming down to the southeastern part here, whether it be Florida or Alabama or what have you, you can visit most of the courses here in the area, and you can actually pick up a copy. They're free. And or you can, as I said, you can visit online and request a copy be sent to you. Some of the larger resorts, of course, also carry the publication, but you can find a little bit more about that by going to southcoastgolfguide.com. If you're somebody that is interested in advertising in Jonathan's guide, it has quite a broad reach. If you're interested in advertising, just contact, reach out to Jonathan at jonathan@southcoastgolfguide.com. You can also view online as well and get other further contact information there. But thank you, Jonathan, always for your continued support of the program. Always look forward to some conversations with you, and always enjoy it when you come on the program. So thank you again to South Coast Golf Guides, Mr. Jonathan Laird. Meredith Kirk, of course, from Meredith Kirk Golf. She was the 2014 Mrs. South Carolina and also entered into the Mrs. USA pageant as well. She's from the Myrtle Beach area. And Meredith, has been on the program a few times. I always enjoy her. Great golf instructor, and works very hard growing this game, not only with some of her regular students, but also with junior golf. And she has a great organization called juniorgolfexchange.org, and where she helps to get some of the equipment, if you will, out to some of these youngsters that maybe don't have access to equipment to play golf. So she's doing her part there. Visit juniorgolfexchange.org and find out how you can help Meredith and her cause in spreading the word and getting some more youngsters exposed to this great game. So thank you, Meredith. And I think also her main website is meredithkirk.com. Excuse me. Nikki and Tiffany Litherland, who always continue to support this program, thank you very much. Originally from Australia, and now here residing in the United States. Nikki's, of course, a professional in the golf business, and Tiffany, of course, is a loving wife and mother, and a great supporter of the program as well. So thank you guys for all of your continued support, and thank you for sharing all of my posts and so forth throughout social media. Mr. Bernie Pinder, can't forget my good buddy Bernie from Ontic Golf. You can visit onticgolf.com. And find out how you can get your hot little hands on one of Bernie's custom-designed putters. I happen to have one. Thank you, Bernie, for that. And I certainly enjoy it and has helped to help my game tremendously. So thank you, Bernie, for that. Go to Ontic. It's O-N-T-I-C, golf.com. Mr. Bernie Pinder will be more than happy to size you up, if you will, for your own custom design putter. It's got some great products there. So make sure you visit the site and get in touch with Bernie. Mr. Sean Kelly, who I've mentioned several times as well, he's the owner of LinkedGolfers.com. And LinkedGolfers.com, of course, is a derivative, if you will, of Linked Golfers Golf Group from LinkedIn, which is a large social network. Of course, and Linked Golfers is the largest golf group in LinkedIn. And Sean has taken that, if you will, in addition to having it in LinkedIn, he's also taken it out and formed a great network, if you will, of great golf professionals and great golf enthusiasts from all over the world through LinkedGolfers.com. So make sure you check that out as well. So thank you, Sean, for all of your continued support. And last but certainly not least, my good buddy, Mr. Peter Doyle from Doyle Golf Solutions over in Ireland. Thank you, Peter, for all of your continued support throughout the program. Peter, of course, is not only a teacher professional, but he's also a club fitter as well, and I believe a master club fitter, if I'm not mistaken. So for those of you in the Europe market particularly, and particularly over in Ireland, make sure that you get in touch with Mr. Peter Doyle from Doyle Golf Solutions. Thank you, Peter, for all of your continued support of Golf Talk Live. And, of course, last but not least, I want to particularly thank all of the listeners from around the world for faithfully tuning in to Golf Talk Live each and every week. I certainly get a great amount of pleasure and enjoyment of having a number of highly talented coaches, teach professionals, authors, and entrepreneurs stop by and share their thoughts. And it's really through their participation and guest appearances that have helped make Golf Talk Live a first-class show. So thank you to all of the listeners, all of the sponsors and supporters of the program. And with that note, I'm going to be heading out here shortly in the next few days on vacation. So as I said earlier, this will be the last broadcast for a week, and then I will be returning back the week of the 20th. So make sure that you tune in the week of the 20th, I believe the 21st Tuesday. Turn into blogtalkradio.com/womenofgolf and join Cindy Miller and I, LPGA professional Cindy Miller and I, Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on blogtalkradio.com. And then again on Thursday, I believe it's July 23rd, I'll be returning back to Golf Talk Live after my vacation. And you can tune in from 6 to 8 p.m. Central Standard Time here on Golf Talk Live. Have a great week, great weekend, everybody. I will see you not next Thursday, but the Thursday after, July 23rd, 6 p.m. Central, right here on Golf Talk Live. God bless, everybody, and thank you for tuning in.